On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we talk about two big extensions. Garrett Crochet extending 6 years, $170 million with the Red Sox. And then Jackson Merrill, whose extension was reported while we were recording this podcast. So you'll hear that conversation towards the back part of the show. We also talk about Jerks and Profar being suspended for PEDs. We open up the mailbag and read your wonderful emails. Hit a few other news and notes before we say goodbye. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows that pod is just one letter from P-E-D. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and there's nothing like a podcast enhancing device.
Yes, we too have been suspended for 80 games for PODs. That is us. We are here to talk about Jerks and Profar's poor decision making. Oh, did he know? Did he not? We'll get into all that.
Good financial decision making, however.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that, of course. We're going to talk about Garrett Crochet getting a hefty extension. Oh, my goodness, did he get a bag from the Boston Red Sox. Speaking of a bag, we're going to open up the mailbag for the middle chunk of this episode. You guys sent us some wonderful emails. We are going to read a healthy selection of them. And then at the end of the show, we are going to go around the league, talk about some things that happened early this week. Some injuries, some debuts, some retirements. We'll see what else we have time for. But Jake, our opener this week is a full-blown starting pitcher.
Garrett Crochet, 6 years, 170 million smackers from the Boston Red Sox, acquired by those Red Sox over the offseason from the Chicago White Sox for a cornucopia of prospects. It was apparent pretty quickly that Boston had interest in extending Garrett Crochet to a long-term deal. Now, remember Crochet's trajectory here, very important. Drafted in 2020 out of the University of Tennessee, debuts that year without appearing in the minor leagues, in part because the minor leagues in 2020 did not exist. He works out of the bullpen for the White Sox, blows out, gets Thomas Johnson, returns from that, and is the opening day starter for the White Sox a year ago. And at the time, on this very podcast, we laughed at that. We said, LOL, what are you doing?
Everyone else was like, what are they thinking? What is going on? All these White Sox, they're going to be so bad. And they were, but a combination of, yeah, exactly.
Without him.
It could have been a lot worse, as Garrett Crochet was simply marvelous. And then also remember that at the deadline last year, because the White Sox were so horrible, it was like, ooh, well, they would certainly be willing to trade Garrett Crochet. But we had an interesting news cycle where Garrett Crochet and his representatives made it clear. They was like, listen, I would love to get traded to a contender. I'm excited to pitch in the postseason, and that's not going to happen if I stay on the White Sox. However, due to my injury history and virtually unprecedented
innings
uptick
bump
in workload, he was looking out for himself and saying, listen, if I'm going to get traded and I'm going to pitch down the stretch into October when I'm going to be blowing past my innings limit, I would prefer to sign an extension. They were not able to work that out with any team at the deadline, so they took it into the offseason, at which point we knew it was going to happen at some point. But what was interesting is once the deal went down with the Red Sox, not only were the Red Sox like, yes, we're interested in extending, Crochet was like, yes, I'm interested in extending, I'd love to be here, this is great, that's all I said all spring. But it went on and on and on, and we made it to opening day. Garrett Crochet starting on opening day again, and he didn't have an extension. And at that point, you know, it wasn't like he was threatening, like, I refuse to talk about this. We know that there's wiggle room with this stuff, as there might still be with Vlad Jr. and these other extensions that could be in play. But it was like, huh, like it was a little interesting. Now, it made sense because it was like, this is probably a complicated extension to hammer out because of the track record and because of, it's just a weird, this is not a free agency deal where you've done it for 5-6 years the way, like, if you're Max Fried or if you're some of these other guys where it's like, all right, well, you've done this over half a decade or more. I know what I'm getting. You've been healthy. Like, this is what I'm paying for. This is betting on a small sample of what he did last year and the fact that he is only 26 years old. And even though he's been in the big leagues now for a half a decade because he debuted immediately, we don't really know what we're getting. And yet the Red Sox clearly believe in what they're getting and were willing to commit a serious amount of money to a pitcher who has really only done it for one season.
They're betting on the package here. They're betting on the traits. They're betting on the fastball. They're betting on the work ethic. They're betting on the athleticism. They're betting that it will continue to be difficult to acquire aces. Garrett Crochet is considered by many people an ace. For me personally, like, I would wait another month. That's just where I'm at. But the Athletic does a survey every year where they try and determine who the actual aces are in the game. And this year there were, I think, six or seven, and Garrett Crochet was one of them. Mm-hmm. And so it is immensely difficult to acquire and keep that type of talent.
Yeah. The other important thing to remember is that the Red Sox were trying to sign Max Fried and were trying to sign Corbin Burnes. Like, they were trying to spend money on pitching. And they, you know, they got Walker Buehler, and we know they've signed Lucas Giolito recently. Like, they have done it in parts, but they're trying to go bigger. So they had seemingly committed, or at least had the idea of, like, we want to invest heavily in a top line starter during this time period. And after already, what makes this interesting is they also already paid hefty price in prospects on top of this extension that they're doing. But this is also part of what redeems that price, because it's not just 2 years of Garrett Crochet. It is now potentially six, maybe seven. And that's another part of this contract that I do think is interesting. So, you know, he's making his $4 million in ARB this year, gets $4 million signing bonus. And then it's basically $28 million a year for the next five seasons, after which, if he stays healthy, he can opt out after 2030, which would be going into his age 32 season, a very normal time for an ace pitcher to reach free agency, at which point he could, if he stays healthy and is great, he could cash in again, whether that's in Boston or elsewhere. However, there's also a clause in this deal, which you do see in big contracts for pitchers, but I think for Crochet it is especially important, where if he spends over 120 days on the injured list due to injury, his opt-out, his opt-out would basically void, and the Red Sox would also get a $15 million team option conditionally for 2032, which would allow them to keep them for even longer. So you see those details. I believe Luis Castillo had a similar detail in his extension with the Mariners. You don't really think about it with guys who are generally durable, even though, as we know, anybody could blow out at any time. But for Crochet, that's a kind of an example of some of the protection that the Red Sox are getting for this. And I think what's also interesting is, we think about, okay, the lack of proven track record. I also have to imagine the fact that they're getting him for these prime years. You could also spin it as, well, he doesn't have a lot of mileage on his arm, you know? And that's right, another thing you could look at when there's free agent pitchers where it's like, man, this, whether it's Corbin Burnes, you're like, man, this guy's thrown a lot. If this starts to go, it might go fast because, you know, that's just the car's only going to drive for so long. Whereas Crochet, yes, you want to be mindful of the workload increase over the last couple of years coming off injury and the fact that he hasn't been starting. But you could also spin it that way and be like, listen, we're getting him in his prime years and he hasn't really thrown that many innings in his early 20s. So I have to imagine that was probably part of the calculus too. But ultimately, you're betting on the best version of Crochet. You look at what he was good at last year. You see the 3.58 ERA and you're like, really? Is this one of the best pitchers in baseball? Well, he had a horrific White Sox defense, obviously. But more importantly, like, the underlying stuff is ridiculous. I mean, his fastball, he was doing it last year with basically two pitches, you know, and to think that there is maybe more development, that there's another pitch he could add, that there's more kind of cultivating the arsenal to where it could be massive, vastly improved, which we know Boston has had success doing. That's really what you're betting on, because the swing and miss stuff, the strikeouts, is basically as good as any starting pitcher we have right now.
What does this mean for the Boston Red Sox? So because of how the deal is structured, it doesn't alter their payroll for this season in any meaningful way. No. Now, moving forward, it is worth pointing out that they have a number of deals that are pretty backloaded, including this one. So Brian Bello's money ticks up next year and the next couple of seasons. You have Sidon Rafaela's money kicks up in the next couple of seasons. Even Rafi Devers, his money kicks up a little bit over the next couple of seasons. And so their payroll, Patrick Sandoval is making 12 next year and only five this year. So like, they're going to start to have more money go in the books, even if they say, don't bring back Buehler, don't bring back Giolito, both of whom they have options for. They're mutual options on those, so they'll probably won't get picked up. But the Red Sox are spending. I think that's what's significant. I think there's been frustration within the fan base towards John Henry, the owner, towards Sam Kennedy, the president, that they haven't been willing to push the chips in. They're doing that now. This is what that is, right? And part of the reason I think they feel comfortable making this investment is because they have these young position player prospects that are matriculating towards the big leagues. Those are players that they're either going to sign to pretty friendly extensions in the next couple of years. Christian Campbell, there's been rumors about an extension for him, or they're going to be paying these dudes the minimum for the next couple of seasons. And so when they're saving money on that front, like there's a world in a year where they have these three guys, Meyer, Campbell, and Anthony, as starting position players at or around the minimum. That's a third of your lineup, right? That is a place where you're saving money that allows you to then spend elsewhere.
Yeah. And that's the other point on that is, I would say, first of all, let's also mention that Chris Cotillo reporting that they are also trying to extend Christian Campbell, which those extensions are always interesting for players that have barely been in the big league. Sometimes we've seen them before players even debut. So what that kind of contract would look like for so many reasons would be interesting. We'll talk about that if that actually happens. But I think the other thing to consider is, I mean, the financials of it too. And yes, the macro point is totally spot on, that like the fact that the Red Sox, it took some time for them to finally do the jump in for Bregman, for them to spend on a pitcher like this for Crochet. We know that the position player core is as good as it gets in baseball, not just what they have at the big league level. I know they haven't been hitting super awesome so far, but you know, what they have at the big level, but also coming to the minors. This is also an acknowledgement that while the pitching development has improved, and you've seen some signs of life, right? Richard Fitz, I think there's reasons to be excited about him, but like there is not a no doubt ace coming down the line for this farm system. This farm system is very, very hitter heavy. And while they have had some wins and what they've, you know, some of the success they've had with guys like Houck in the big leagues, but the reality is for just contract wise, like not expecting Buehler to be back, whether he's good or not, not expecting Giolito to be back. Like there are going to be holes in this rotation as soon as next year. And having something that you can build around on the staff is clearly something that they were trying to do, because those prospects just don't really exist right now in their system, with all due respect to the David Sandlins of the world. So that is, I think, also part of why they were so willing, and clearly why they wanted to go after someone like Fried or Burns to kind of build the rotation around.
They are still paying Eric Hosmer, by the way. Now, they're getting money from San Diego to do that, but it does show up on their books that they are paying Eric Hosmer $13 million a year, and then San Diego is paying them to be on our podcast. Love that. Enough about the Red Sox.
Yes.
Let's talk about something less savory.
Yeah.
Jurickson Profar, the former top prospect in baseball, a man with a megawatt smile, in some ways the reason you and I became friends.
Yes. We have referenced this on the show before, but, or like when we're telling like, oh, how do you guys do all this? What's going on? Yeah. What's the deal? How did Family Barbecue start? Well, when Jake and I were like realizing that we were the only two people that wanted to like talk about baseball all the time in high school is when Jurickson Profar was a top prospect, was this phenom, this switch hitting shortstop who raced to the big leagues as a teenager and just seemed to be good at everything and had this unusual name, as we were like, oh, Jurickson, whoa, we haven't seen a lot of those. You know, we're used to Kyles and Tylers and Logans, but how about, or even a Jose, but not a lot of Jurickson's. Like, this is great. Like, this name, I just want to talk about Jurickson Profar. Like, this is, he was in the Little League World Series. He's, you know, again, you make the big leagues at that age, as because we're basically, what are we?
That
like,
age.
Basically, yeah, whatever. We're a couple years younger than him, right? So it's like, oh my God, this he's the next big thing. And then it just is just kind of moseys along for like 10 years. Like he's around, he's on a couple teams, and it's like, okay, well, it was kind of a lesson in prospecting where it was like, oh, all right, well, he's just kind of there. He had some injuries, of course. And he's just been kind of plodding along for the last decade. And then last year, Jurickson Profar just goes absolutely ham. I mean, it was one of the best stories in baseball last year, frankly. I mean, it was, right? Of course, as part of that Padres team, he signs for $1 million. Now, he had been on the Padres before and had had some success, but after ending up on the Rockies and it seemed like his career was not going in the right direction, he ends up back on the Padres for $1 million and is one of the best players in baseball. And across the line, he was just better at everything. And he was a huge part of that team. And then he was a free agent. And in the offseason, when the Padres were pretending to be broke or at least had reasons to not spend any money, it was like, and remember, Profar stayed out there on the market for a while, and it was like, oh, are they holding out to bring back Profar? Because we know they love Profar so much. Ultimately, the Padres don't do that. He goes to Atlanta, which seemed like a perfect fit, absolutely perfect fit, right? It was like, great. This outfield is going to be, whew. I mean, when you get him and Harrison and Acuna in July, well, we still might get that, but we're not going to get it any sooner, as Jurickson Profar has been suspended for 80 games for testing positive for a banned substance known as HCG. This is what Manny Ramirez was popped for the first time he got suspended in 2009.
That's a throwback.
Yeah. So, you know, where you used to hear, oh, the close to ball and stanozolol and just like straight drugs. This appears to be more of along the lines of what you're taking to hide your drugs. And he failed, or whatever, whoever failed. Somebody failed here, and Jurickson Profar tested positive. And he, of course, puts out a statement, as most people who test positive for PEDs do. And he said, I am very regretful and sad and sorry. I was tested. He made it a point to say in his statement, I was tested 8 times last year.
I want to say that. I want to touch on this.
Yeah.
Miss me with that garbage.
Yeah.
That's like saying, oh, well, I didn't kill these other 30 people.
It doesn't matter to me. To me, it's also like almost an acknowledgement of what everybody is thinking, which is, oh my God, you were amazing last year out of nowhere. And he's like, no, but I was tested positive last year. I was tested, okay. I was clean last year. But no, I agree with you. It's like, well that doesn't matter right now. You're suspended.
No, but it's not even that doesn't matter right now. It's just that that's not conclusive. Like, sure. If he was taking this stuff and it didn't reach a level where it was noticed, but it was at a level where it was influencing him.
Congrats. You were cheating better then and not now.
He does not deserve the benefit of the doubt here. Right. The idea that he tried to insert the implication that what he did before was clean, like, I don't care, dude. Like,
oh, 100%.
You don't get that. You don't get the trust on that front. And like, when you look at the numbers from last season and you look at what he was a lot better at, it was impacting the baseball with authority. Steroids, PEDs, are not necessarily strength builders, right? I think that's a general misconception. Remember, D. Gordon, the skinniest boy, tested positive for these. These help with a lot of different things. That being said, when you have such a dramatic uptick in one particular category, Profar had the single largest year-over-year jump an average exit velocity and hard hit percentage from 2023 to 2024. When you take that information and then we get this news that he got popped, it is impossible not to draw a line between those two things.
Yeah, and that sucks because we want to believe that people can make mistakes, or that in some cases people, I know they always say, I've never knowingly taken this. There are people around players that I'm sure end up putting players in bad positions, and I'm sure that that has happened. And I'm sure that there is some range of players who have been suspended over the years that there is a range of he knew exactly what he's doing 100% of the time and was trying to get away with it versus he was turned a blind eye, trusted the wrong doctor, XYZ. Like, there's versions of all of this. And ultimately, we are not actually going to know in most cases what actually happened. But it doesn't matter, because to your point, in this case, as much as we always want to believe the player and want to believe the player that these players are all clean and all trying to play the game the right way, whatever it is, this is not a case where anybody is going to give him the benefit of the doubt, and that sucks. But that's what you end up with. And even if it was a mistake, well, guess what? Shouldn't have had the mistake happen after the year that you just had, because no one is really going to trust you again. Which brings us, let's spin this forward, right?
Well, I just want to say, two other things here. Don't feel too bad for Profar, okay? he, before this contract, had made $35 million in his career. Yes, it is something of a bummer that he never lived up to the hype, and it wasn't a $350 million player. But it's not as if Jurickson Profar was living in in public housing, okay? He had more than enough money to be a, financially secure human being. What he did to, in a way, parlay one great season into a significant raise, he's still going to get a lot of that money. The way that this contract is structured is 12 mil this year, 15 next year, 15 the year after that. He does not get paid for the time he is suspended. I believe that's going to work out to he'll lose 6 mil this year, maybe a little bit more. And he'll still get paid millions this season, more than what he was making last year. And then he'll show up to camp next year and he'll get paid 15 and he'll get paid 15 the year after that. Now, I would say generally, you and I are more forgiving and less harsh when it comes to PED suspensions than the average person who does what we do for a living, right? And that is because at the end of the day, we want to watch ball go far. We want to enjoy the game. We are at a point now where Fernando Tatis Jr., who is Profar's teammate, who got popped in 2022, that's just not something I think about anymore. It's like, I was looking at the list of players who've been suspended in the major leagues, and there are dudes still in the big leagues. I just forgot they got popped. Like Jorge Polanco got a suspension. Starling Marte got a suspension.
Yep.
Now that stuff matters, obviously. Nelson Cruz, who turned his entire reputation around after getting suspended, right?
Mm-hmm.
That stuff matters, and I think it's how you handle it moving forward. But I think the vitriol and the frustration that is directed towards Profar right now is valid. And I think particularly inside clubhouses is where it matters. That black mark remains. We have talked to people who played with and against Nelson Cruz in the latter half of his career when he was very likable. And there were still comments like, oh, well, he's a cheater. Oh, that's never a guy I'm going to trust what he has to say.
And we listen, we always say this too, because like we're trying to balance the perspective of giving you our authentic feelings on this, because that's our job, and also trying to communicate and convey what people in baseball are saying. And yeah, when we talk to players, you mentioned Cruz, people still say that about Tatis, right? There are still players that look at Tatis and will never trust him, or will never take him seriously, or whatever. Now we know Tatis, and this is part of every PD user story as they come back, is, all right, Profar, are you good? What does this look like? And in his case in particular, it will genuinely be very interesting how he performs both at the end of this year and for the rest of his Braves contract coming off of last season.
I agree with you. However, the effects of PEDs don't just go away.
That's also true. That's also true.
They can linger, right? You build a base.
But we've seen versions where,
Johnny Peralta.
Brady Anderson. There's some ones where it's like, all right, well, now he's just bad. Whatever. So as we mentioned, there's nuance, there's a range for all of these things because we don't know exactly the specifics. I do also think that right now, as we zoom out farther and bring in the Braves into this conversation.
One more thing. It's on the scale of humanity, it doesn't matter to me, relatively. There are worse transgressions. There are people currently playing in the major leagues who have done worse things. And so I struggle to get to a point with PED suspensions where I am like fuming.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I understand that it is a different conversation with the sanctity of the game and the fairness of what's happening on the field of play. I understand that. But when I break it down and I'm like, oh, well, that guy like beat a woman versus, took some drugs to make more money to hit a ball far. Like, I just struggle to get to that point. Okay.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about the Atlanta Braves, who suck right now.
Yeah. So that is also part of the context here. Now, I guess if Profar had signed with the Blue Jays or with the Royals and this had happened, we would have been having the same conversation about his year last year. But this is also another bit of bad news for the only winless team left in baseball as we record this on early Wednesday morning, as the Braves, who tough assignment starting the year in San Diego and in Los Angeles. Recognize that. However, if you're supposed to be one of the best teams in baseball, we would presume you would get a win along those first few games. And I guess let's first quickly acknowledge like what the plan is in the outfield. The Braves did happen to sign Alex Verdugo in March, and we were like, why?
Huh.
Do we know for sure? I think it is plausible that the Braves knew that this... Now, I think it's also, let's be clear, they should not have... They did not know this when they gave him $40 million, but I think it is plausible the way that the timings of these things work that they could have known that this was coming by the time they signed Alex Verdugo. But either way, Verdugo, they claim Stuart Fairchild on waivers. They're still going to have to patch it together until Acuna gets back. But the problem right now is not, okay, great, now you lose Profar. I think Mark Bowman has just wrote about this last night after their latest loss. I mean, this is like the worst offensive stretch in franchise history, even if you look at a tiny sample. I mean, it's like, I think I've like, they've never hit whatever 140 over six games in like 80 years or something. Like, dude, this team stinks right now. And I have a couple interesting comps for this, but what? Yeah, I mean, you're the one that picked the Braves to win the World Series, I think.
Yeah, don't feel good about that. Look, overreacting yeah. at this point is stupid. I would retract that pick, though, for not because the offense looks so bad. One, because of the Profar getting popped thing. Two, because Reynaldo Lopez looks like he's going to be out for 5 to 6 months. Like
a shoulder injury, surgery. He's not going to be a factor. Yeah.
I will say, dude, this offense has not scored a earned run since Friday.
So you're telling me that the scoreless... Wait, really? No, that's not right.
They were shut out on Saturday. They were shut out on Sunday.
But Michael Harris homered against Tanner Scott.
Michael Harris homered against Tanner Scott.
Yes.
I will retract that as well.
He earned that.
They've scored one run. One run. They've scored one run since Friday.
It hasn't been much better. They have been, the offense has been atrocious. And that was our big talking point when we previewed the Braves. It was like, okay, the good players are still in place. You're going to get Acuna back. Okay, maybe you're not as good as 2023, but you're also not as bad as 2024. There's no way. Like, this should still be a good offense. And so far, it's been... Now, again, you're facing really, really good teams. You face the two teams that haven't lost. The one team that hasn't won is face the two teams that haven't lost. So, that's a tough assignment. The comp I was going to make...
Randy Vasquez, again, kick your ass, though. Like,
right, exactly. That's a very important point. I'm just going to bring in, because it's top of mind, bring in some college baseball for a second here. It's very different because the season is a lot longer. But I think about a team like the University of Florida right now. It was highly hyped coming into the season. They started their SEC schedule against Tennessee, the best team in the country, and Georgia, who is apparently also one of the three best teams in the country. And they started SEC play 0-6, and it was like, oh my God, like disaster, catastrophic, season's over. And then you're like, okay, well, you were playing the two really good teams, and you're not going to play that many better teams from here on out. Now, in Florida's case, you know, the SEC schedule is 30 games. Eventually, the math is just not in your favor, and you cannot get to enough wins to make the postseason. The Braves obviously have more than enough games to get back in their favor. However, in the National League East, which we thought was going to be this massive three-horse race, there is going to be a point where it's like, okay, this is going to get hard to catch the Phillies. Like, that's true. Is it stupid to say that after 1 week? Sure. But when you look this bad and you have zero wins and the other teams are getting wins at normal paces, yeah, at some point you're going to look up and you're 10 games back and you're going to say, all right, we got a lot of work to do. And if you're just going to throw your hands up and say, all right, Strider and Acuna save us, they are talented enough to maybe that is a decent strategy. But like, what's their record going to be by the time those guys come back at this point? It seems like Strider's closer to coming back than Acuna. But, I mean, obviously their schedule is going to let up a little bit here. It's not like their season's over. But I guess this is the wrong division to get. If you're in the Central, okay, great. You could start 0-7 and you'll be fine. You probably don't have that luxury starting in this division. So we'll see how much worse
it gets. Big game tonight. Need a win to finish off the series against the Dodgers, or else home opener on Friday against the Marlins is going to have a very bizarre energy around it. Speaking of bizarre energies, let's take a break. And when we get back, we will open up the mailbag. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. This is not just our show. It's your show, too. We appreciate, I gotta say, Jordan, I am genuinely humbled by the number of kind emails we have gotten over the last couple of weeks. Not to toot our own collective horn, but it is fulfilling and meaningful to hear from you folks. We don't always do the best job at responding in a timely manner because, you know, we're horrible human beings, but it does mean a lot to us, and keep doing it. Keep emailing, because we do read all of them.
Thank you for listening, and you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We have six emails that we are going to read. Way more than six, but we are going to pick our six favorites for now. Maybe we'll get to some other ones in the future. And we're going to begin with an email from Grace.
Bat chat continues. Grace says, "Hi, Jake and Jordan. Honored to be the millionth person writing to you with bat somewhere in the subject or email text. And I hate to say it, but it's more of a comment than a question. I'm a Formula One fan first and an invested baseball fan former recently, which has colored my view of the whole bat saga from this weekend. I think the discourse is hilarious. F1 is a sport that invests deeply to the tunes of hundreds of million annually to aerodynamically and mechanically perfect two cars that race 24 times in a year. Baseball is another highly data-driven sport now, but the human performance and human presence is so central to the sport's identity in a way that differs from F1. To my limited experience, baseball's material and technological innovation is developed in a way that assesses, supports, and maximizes human performance. F1 is almost the opposite, where drivers train to adapt to and support the ideal operating setup of a car. Both sports work hard to overcome, but are ultimately shaped by human error and random circumstance. Anyway, all that to say, I saw the bats and was like, hell yeah, fresh tech gimmick. This is great. It seems legal. It uses physics and common sense to support the athlete's natural ability, and it looks funny. We get this discourse like once a week in the F1 world." Grace goes on to say a bunch more interesting things, but we're going to cut it off there. I found this email incredibly compelling.
Yeah. I mean, I learned a lot. I don't follow F1 and don't necessarily plan to anytime soon. However, the additional details that Grace supplied involving the specifics of how, you know, different companies and teams are, you know, maximizing and perfecting their technology for the drivers and how the drivers are adapting to the technology that they're using. I think this is really interesting, and this is one of the things that I am most compelled by when it comes to the bats. And you gave the comparison of, and obviously other people have given the comparison to, you know, a club fitting in golf and making the equipment fit the actual player as much as best it can to maximize the human performance. But yeah, I mean, that is what is compelling about it. This in particular is just so funny because we've gone years and years and years not trying to change the most obvious piece of equipment in the entire sport. And so I think, although it is funny, you think about it in other ways, like what are some other pieces of equipment that have changed? You know, the base, the size of the bases, you know, that counts as something that it's like, this is something that we can change that will alter how the humans interact with the field of play. But the bat being the thing, and this is why this story has resonated to such an extreme degree, is because something that has looked the same for so long to suddenly look slightly different. I mentioned kind of the same thing with the bases. And by the way, do we notice the base anymore? No. When we first got them, we're like, oh my God, look at these pizza boxes. And now it's like, yeah, that's what the bases look like.
Now, what I find compelling about the bat conversation is that we did this in college baseball with aluminum bats like 15
years ago. I was
going to
bring this up last time. Yeah. Yep.
And for those of you who are not nerds like us, for a long time, college baseball bats, because they're made of aluminum, made of metal, the ball comes off harder. And that was not necessarily regulated for a really long time. And there was a bat classification called BESR bats, Beezers, right? And now we are in the BB Corps era. Am I mixing that up?
No, you got it. Excuse me. You're right. That's correct.
Yeah, now we're in the BB Corps era. And the idea between those two is that there is a certain amount of like the materials in the bat need to mimic or need to be limited. There's almost like a governor on them, right?
Yes.
And so now it seems like bat companies, the metal bat companies, have kind of figured that out. And mm-hmm. we've seen an explosion of offense at the college level again. Mm-hmm. And so this conversation of tech and where we limit tech to ensure fairness has existed in baseball and specifically with bats. Now, because wood as a material is more limited in what you can physically do with it, we haven't really had this yet. I think there is a scenario in the next year where the torpedo bat users see their offense jump significantly, where there is some level of regulation that needs to happen. I don't think that is what will happen. I think that mm-hmm. is a potential pathway. Mm-hmm. And that is not abnormal. We see this all the time in sports and in life, right?
Yeah.
You need to regulate new tech.
Mm-hmm. So the thing that I'm compelled by, and as it relates to Grace's email and just the concept of tailoring the bat to the player, is what I am tracking most closely in the coming weeks is right now, because it's such a thing, everybody's like, I'm going to give it a try. And you haven't really identified a pattern of what kinds of players are actually trying this.
Yeah.
But another key point that I don't think we mentioned when we first talked about this earlier this week, because I don't think it was as clear or had been reported as clearly, is Giancarlo Stanton. And that Giancarlo Stanton was using some version of this in the postseason last year. Now, maybe it wasn't pronounced.
Back, yeah. As far back as May. So as I May. Wrote about this yesterday and did a little deep dive into Getty photos. Uh-huh. And you can see it as far back as May.
Yeah. So, and the reason I mentioned that is because, I mean, that's interesting for its own reason, which is that, like, how did nobody notice this for months and months and months? So that's true. But I want to focus on the fact that it was Giancarlo Stanton. Because when we talked about what is the point of this bat, I think we're still learning this, right? I understand now it is about allowing the player to hit the ball more often where the actual sweet spot is, or providing more mass in the bat at the place where the players are striking the ball. But I am curious if we do start to identify or see what kinds of hitters are either benefiting from this or searching for this. Because I brought up the concept of, okay, is this helping players make more contact overall? Well, you could say, well, not really, because maybe, I guess, if they have slightly more barrel in this place, they're more likely to hit the ball to some degree. But I think it's also as much about the quality of the contact. Now, you would think that if anybody wouldn't necessarily need to fix the quality of contact, it would be Giancarlo Stanton. And you would think more along the lines of a player like a Volpe, a player like a Jazz player, a guy who doesn't necessarily have big raw power that is
so
now,
I think
okay,
it's
we're
more
leaning
a guy,
on the bat.
I think it's more of a guy with bat speed, but worse barrel control, where when they have to kind of swing harder, if that makes sense. Again, we're just kind of guessing at this point, but
that's,
you are right that
Stan
doesn't feel like the exact kind of guy.
Right.
And so I need someone smarter than me to explain to me why Stan is the right kind of guy to use this.
Yes. And I know our you know, the Mr. Aaron Lenhart, the Marlins field coordinator. That's why I'm rocking the fighting fish today, not just because they beat the Mets. But Lenny, Hilarious. As he is known, who is now doing, you know, global interviews in front of the Marlins dugout.
Hilarious.
So funny. The former MIT physicist who told the Yankees, like, hey, why don't we try this? I think that, like, obviously he's talked about it. He talked about Stan, and there's a lot of interesting quotes about that. But that's the thing, as it relates to Grace's email, that I'm most compelled by. Who are the players that are benefiting from this? Who are the players that stick with this, that realize that, like, this is something that can help me? And then who are the ones, as we know, that of course there's going to be people like Freddie Freeman and Aaron Judge who are like, why would I change anything?
Have you watched me play baseball?
Yeah, and that's great, and that's fine. And so if this is just something to monitor, it'll be a little bit hard to track. I think that's something I'm a little bit wary of, is like, we are now at a point where we can track so many things. And like, are we really going to have an objective monitoring of when these bats are being used and when they're not? That's what's going to be difficult here to keep this, to be able to sort through all this data that we are now maybe going to get. But obviously it is a big story, and that is why we keep talking about it.
My take is that Volpe will be the face of this. He's going to make the All-Star team. And in 5 years, when we remember this time, it will be him. Our next email. is from Ian. Ian drops a ton of questions, but we're going to focus on one. Jacob Jordan, baseball's back, and so are my questions that I thought were pretty good. Should the Dodgers have a name? Well, besides the Dodgers. Like Big Red Machine, Bronx Bombers, Harvey's Wallbangers. And if they should have a name, what should the name be? Now, we've seen this before, right? Like teams with names. The Gas House Gang in the 1934 Cardinals, the Bash Brothers, We Are Family Pirates, the Blake Street Bombers, which is hilarious, with the Rockies.
That's a good one. We had the Bomba Squad with the Twins a few years back. Now, everybody was the Bomba Squad in 2019, but they were the leaders. So we you know, respect.
Now, do the Dodgers deserve a name is one question, because better teams than these Dodgers did not have a name. What do we call the Yankees in the late 1990s? We call them the late 90s Yankees. You know, there is no, call them Jeter's Yankees. There's no nickname for that team. So I think that it does need to happen grassroots. It does need to happen authentically. You can't just be like, you're good, you get a nickname. Another example of that is when you go to Giancarlo Stanton's MLB page and it says that his nickname is Parmesan Carlo, a name that no one has ever called him to his face at any point in his life. You can't just be like, this is like when you're in middle school, be like, I need a nickname. Someone call me Triple X. Someone call me the big guy.
The Sports Reference nicknames are at this point a bit of a meme. I think we know that those are not often used in the lexicon. I love this question. I do think that we should we can brainstorm a little now. We can crowdsource. Let us know, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. To me,
I got one.
Okay,
I got one.
Go ahead.
The blue wall.
The blue. You can just do the big blue machine. I don't know how the Reds are going to feel about that, but they have, you know. It's to me, it needs to be something that conveys like omnipotence, like something that's just so big you cannot quite grasp your mind around. And I do think that Guggenheim, we need to lean into the Guggenheim, the big G, the big Guggenheim. This is what is making all of this possible. We know it's all about the players. We know it's players. Players make the sport. That's the point.
Okay.
But from a financial standpoint, this is what is powering this. And the financial part of this is a big part of this.
How about the Guggenheim Project? Like the Manhattan Project, Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen, very omnipotent.
I think that's great. Now it's kind of weird to call the team, like, that doesn't really fit into like a call where, you know, like Mookie hits a big home run like he did
the
again last night.
Guggenheim Project strikes again.
So that's a little clunky in that sense, but I think that that gets at what I am trying to, I think, should be
continued. Dude.
Now, I don't think the Dodgers would appreciate that. So like, what do you think the actual players would like to be? Because again,
they certainly
wouldn't
appreciate the blue wall, Blake Trinan.
Probably not. I would imagine that would not be as appreciated. But also, you know, okay, are we doing like, again, we've already said that we ascribe, okay, well, now they're the evil empire. We know some other teams have, other people have given them nicknames based on them being like a rival, like the Padres, right? I know the late Peter Seidler, they're calling them, you know, the dragon up the freeway or whatever, like stuff like that. So there's versions like that. It's just it depends on how much they want to embrace being the bad guys. The bad guys.
The bad guys.
You know, like how simple do we need to go here? Is there something around the big three, right? Of Ohtani, Betts, Freeman. Is there something around, like, I don't know. There's a lot of ways that this could
Japanese national baseball team.
That would be, you're right, Samurai Japan. Just call them Samurai Japan. That would be the other option. You know, again, they've leaned into this. I know the Dodgers hype video for this season was all about like, we're monsters, and they used like the Godzilla theme music, which was clearly an intentional choice.
Monsters Inc.
Okay, all right. We're working towards something here. We got a little bit of the Hollywood angle there, so maybe you can lean into that.
But the thing about Monsters Inc. is the takeaway is that the monsters aren't actually scary.
That's true. Right.
So maybe it's a good nickname if they lose in the NLDS.
Yeah. So, I think, again, I what I'm throwing out there, what I would love for people to latch onto is something Guggenheim, something
monstrous.
Something monstrous. We'll work on it. Thank you for
email
your
us. Yeah. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. Next email from Luke. Dearest J&J, I know it's only been 5 games, but I can't help but be excited by my Giants. The way we built this roster truly feels 2023 Rangers-esque. 2 down ballot MVP vote veterans manning the infield, an innings eater Chad, a super old rotation, vet with experience, young talent, 2 to 3 years into their career, and of course a bullpen rando that's better than you might think. I also need your thoughts on Heliot Ramos, as I am 1,000% in on him breaking both Bonds-related curses, 30 homers this year, and starting in left field this opening day and next. Once again, Luke. Okay, so Luke, I love that you're amped. Get excited.
Hell yeah, Luke.
This is Corey Seager slander, this email, yes. Is my first takeaway. Corey Seager in 2023 was on a different hemisphere than either Matt Chapman or Willy Adames are right now. I think Chapman and Adames were good players. Adames has actually been pretty terrible to start the season, I think.
Yeah.
Chapman's good. He's a good player.
Chapman's good.
Really. Corey Seager, dude. Corey Seager, I'm telling you. Corey Seager 2023 was a different freaking beast. The other difference, I think, is it's not that I don't trust the infrastructure that the Giants have. I don't know what it is. Bingo. I don't know what Buster Posey is. I don't know that he could supplement a roster. Now, to be fair, Chris Young was relatively new to the job then when he was leading that Rangers team as a forward player, and it turned out that he could do it, and he surprised some people. So I think that's fair. Let's wait a little. Let's wait a couple of weeks before we start comparing the 2025 Giants to World Series teams. However, enjoy it.
Yeah. Just let's have fun. The other two things I would mention in terms of that comp, not to harp too much on it. One would be, like, again, the Rangers. I feel better about the Giants bullpen now, even knowing that the Rangers won the World Series. Like, it's not a good thing. Like, you should be glad you have, you know, Ryan Walker and some of these other guys. Randy Rodriguez. Oh, man, you ever watch that guy? And then here's the other thing that's just a little bit disrespectful, which is ironic. Bruce Bochy. You don't got Bruce Bochy. Hello?
Yeah, you know him.
Yeah, you're familiar with Bruce Bochy's game. Like, maybe you could bring him back if, say, the Rangers stink and the Giants are awesome and Bochy's like, all right, you know, like, this is my last year managing, but I'm going to finish in San Francisco. And you get rid of Bob Melvin, because what has he ever won? He's won Manager of the Year. Has he ever won anything in the postseason? I don't think so. Yeah, Bochy. Hello. Like, that's what a massive part of that story that you're just glossing over, ironically. So anyway, enjoy it, Luke. Enjoy it, Luke.
Enjoy. I still think they're the fourth best team. I do think Aleix Ramos breaking those two records, which is the Giants 100%. Have not had a 30 homer season since Barry Bonds, and they have not had a player started left field on back to back seasons on opening day. I think he's more likely to break the second of those two.
100%. I mentioned that in the power rankings that I wrote this week, Yahoo, like, the 30 homers, I'll believe it when I see it. But yeah, he is tracking to be the left fielder in 2026 in a way that is pretty shocking. So, Heliot Ramos, cheers to you. Who's our next email?
Our next email is from Jeremy. Jeremy says, hi, Jake and Jordan. Kyle Manzardo's nickname surely has to be one of Godzilla, T-Rex, or MASH. Just thought I'd throw these into the ring. Now, we, on a recent podcast, talked about Kyle Manzardo, the only big leaguer currently who is from Idaho. And I proposed naming him Spud. Now, this was argued against by someone on Blue Sky. Do you have it in front of you?
Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't. I thought we got an email about this.
Anyway, the notion was that Kyle Manzardo is not from the potato part of Idaho, and that calling him Spud would be stolen valor.
Yes. Which is, like, a super valid point. I didn't know, what was it? Stolen potato valor is, I believe, the phrase that this person used.
I then spent a good amount of time on agricultural maps of Idaho to double check this claim, and it is in fact correct. The amount of potato production up near Coeur d'Alene, where Kyle Manzardo is from, is quite low.
Yes, this is from at the dishwasher. The dishwasher on Blue Sky said about Combine Sergeant Stone, he's not from the potato part of Idaho, so a potato-based nickname would be Stolen Potato Valor. That's such a great one because, it's just like, have the three words Stolen Potato Valor ever been combined?
Okay.
I don't know, but I love that it is. So anyway, you have some non-potato suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as anybody does, I spent a lot of time on the Coeur d'Alene Wikipedia page learning about it, third largest city in the state. And it seems like mining was kind of a key industry around there. So I would say that we call Kyle Manzardo the rock hound, which is a term commonly used to describe geology enthusiasts. However, I think it's just someone who breaks and collects rocks. And I think rock hound really emphasizes, you know, he's rocking the ball. He's breaking it with a stick. Hitting the rock. Sure. I'm going to just say Kyle the Rock. And sounds awesome.
It sounds cool.
By the way, if I told you that, you know, they called Mike Schmidt the Rock Hound, you'd be like, yeah, dude. Like that.
Of course.
Sounds like That's a true. Baseball nickname.
It is believable. So I will give you credit for that. We will see if we can get that to latch on there. Our next email is from Jacob. Jacob says, "Love the pod, gents."
Not me though.
Not you.
Not me.
Jacob. Yeah. Don't worry. That you're Jake, not Jacob.
Okay.
Jacob says, "Love the pod, gents." I also love the pod. Thank you, Jacob.
I do love it.
Glad you do. I'm glad you do.
I love it, dude. I love it. Curious
which players you're most interested to watch this year. Not necessarily the stars like Ohtani or Ellie De La Cruz, although we're excited to watch them. Guys who are under the radar or fun. Guys where it's a big year and you're interested to see how they do in MLB, but also in college and high school. Guys, as an avid draft fan, keep up the great work. I jotted a few names down. Do you have any that come to mind?
Both Tampa Bay Rays named Shane. Ooh. Shane Boz, Shane McClanahan.
Okay, yes. Dude, Boz.
That comes to mind.
Boz last night. Again, mine is tilted towards what we've seen so far this season, but Boz was cooking against the Pirates. Oh, yeah. Talk about having a tough start to the year, those Buccos. But yeah, Shane Boz, yeah, both of those are good. Yeah,
Jackson Holliday, who looks better already. Spencer Torkelson, who made some really interesting mechanical changes that you can zoom in and feel really good about. I'm excited about him. Those are the ones that kind of jump out. I'm excited to see whether the fast guys who make contact can sustain performance in the big league. So, like, we talked about Chandler Simpson a lot, but that's like Victor Scott, players along that line.
Mm-hmm. I am interested, on the theme of number one overall picks, you mentioned Torque and Jackson Holliday. Casey Mize looked awesome against the Mariners last night. Obviously, everyone's looking awesome against the Mariners right now, but Casey Mize, after a great spring, looked very, very, very good. Kyron Paris is having a nice little run here with the Angels, who are off to a nice start. He was just a top prospect of them for a while. He was tracking like someone where it was like, great, the Angels rushed a guy to the big leagues again, and he was a former high school pick, not a college guy that just skipped the minor leagues like some of these other guys. And it was like, I don't know if this is going to work. He made a swing change. He looks very interesting this year. And then I'll give you one amateur one that I just want to put on people's radar. Are you aware of the Corona High School situation right now this year?
I am, but go ahead.
Okay. There is a school in California, Corona High School, which is currently, I believe their record this year is, I think, 13. They are 13-0 with like a plus 95 run differential. And the reason I'm mentioning them is they have three players who could be first round picks this year, which I believe would be unprecedented. They have a pitcher named Seth Hernandez, a shortstop named Billy Carlson, who's also a pitcher. And then Brady Ebel, who is the son of Dodgers coach Dino Ebel, is also on this team. But this Corona team, every few years you have a high school team where it's like, oh my God, this is an unprecedented amount of talent. This is the one this year, and I am most interested to see if they finish the year undefeated with some sort of, you know, California high school record run differential, because that is what they are on track for now. So there you go, Corona High School.
I like California high school teams that could, like, win a Division III national championship.
Yeah, I don't think any of these kids. Maybe, actually, they probably have some kids on the bench that are going to Sky X schools. I'm sure they do. One more email. Yeah.
Last email.
I like this one. This is good.
This is a great email. This one made me quite happy. This is from Sam. Sam says, first homer in Sacramento. Jacob Wilson hit the A's first homer in Sacramento. Surely that's earned the ball a ticket to Cooperstown, right? However, it's also Jacob Wilson's first career home run. Who gets the ball? Please don't saw it in half. Haven't the A's had enough taken from them, Sam? So, Sacramento hosted games. It looks significantly more rinky-dink than what's going on at the Stein, George Steinbrenner Field. And that is because the Yankees have, they play there for a month and a half every year. And so it has to have a level of niceness. Yankee standards. I think that is relevant to this question. Because how much does the Hall of Fame want to commemorate the A's unsavory pit stop in Sacramento? The league certainly doesn't want you to think too hard about it, in my opinion. The Hall of Fame, maybe that's a different story. My guess is that this ball belongs to Jacob Wilson.
I think so too. I know they, you know, the first pitch from Joey Estes before he started giving up a bunch of runs, I know they saved that ball. Hopefully that's enough to commemorate. That said, we know exactly who to ask about this. So we can give our dear friend John Shestakovsky at the Baseball Hall of Fame a text or a call and be like, hey, dude, what happens in a situation like this? Because there are probably, there's a scenario that is like this that is honestly more compelling from this perspective that is maybe more of a difficult decision. But I agree. I would imagine that Jacob Wilson will get this ball.
Like if J.J. Bleday had hit this and it was his 39th career homer, it's probably going to the Hall.
Now, of course. I'm just saying if there was another stadium, like something else, like another new stadium, say the expansion team and a player, like that would be more celebratory, that would feel more important. But it is interesting, and I plan to text John and ask him if he has an answer for this.
Please update all of us, Jordan. Let's take a break, and when we get back, we will go around the league and hit some little nuggets. And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. As we were recording our last segment, a little news nugget breaking. All caps breaking from Robert Murray. All caps breaking. Jackson Merrill and the San Diego Padres are in agreement on a 9-year, $135 million contract extension. Sources say the deal, which can max out at $204 million and includes a $30 million club option for a 10th season, that can convert to a player option, that's confusing, I think, to my dumb brain, was negotiated by Drew Hardy and Josh Knipp of KHG Sports. This news was then confirmed by our very own Russ Dorsey. Heck yeah, first of all. Money to young players, good. I have to say, this number is lower than what I thought it was going to be. 9-135. I still think we need to know more about how it goes from 135 to 204. Is there a signing bonus? You know, all these things will kind of change the overall full value of the deal. So it is a little bit early to give a final opinion on it, but because the news just broke, we got to mention it.
Yeah, I mean, we can probably have a longer Jackson Merrill conversation on Friday when we have a little bit more details about this, but this is, on the one hand, what you just said, which is, oh, this seems light, speaks to how good this guy was as a rookie last year. Yeah. But look at it the other way. Jackson Merrill went from like fairly stunning first round pick from a Maryland high school, which is not normally a place that is churning out future big league all-stars, and to hit his way to the big leagues for the Padres to just throw him in the deep end of the pool at the start of last season and say, hey, dude, go play center field, even though you've never done it before. For him to figure that out, for him to legitimately challenge Paul Skeens for rookie of the year and already continues to look great. This is exactly the kind of player that you can imagine the Padres under Peter Seidler would be super interested in giving a massive extension. And this one makes way more sense than the other extensions that they are handing out to the likes of 37-year-old Yu Darvish or 30-year-old Jay Cronenworth or a 32-year-old Manny Machado. Like, we've talked about how much money the Padres have put towards their roster in an not to mention Xander Bogaerts, of course, giving super long contracts to some of these players. Giving one to a 22-year-old makes all the sense in the world to guarantee that this guy, who, if he, you know, had Scott Boras or was committed to getting a free agency, could have gotten a free agency when he was 26 or 27, and maybe he would have been the player that signed for $1 billion, whatever. I mean, again, I'm getting carried away. But instead, what is very clear is that the Padres believe in Jackson Merrill. Jackson Merrill believes in the Padres. Jackson Merrill loves being a Padre, and this was something that, even with the new ownership, I have to imagine the organization recognized the opportunity to secure someone who is already one of the best players in the league for a decade. And I imagine if you're Jackson Merrill and you have, we mentioned, yes, because he's so good that 135 or whatever the number is seems light, that's also a hell of a guarantee to get when you're 22 and have played 1 year in the big leagues. So in a slightly different but sort of similar way that we talked about with Garrett Crochet, which is, you know, maybe Garrett Crochet could have gotten $250 million if he got into free agency in 2 years. Maybe Jackson Merrill could have gotten $600, $700 million in 5 years. But instead, he loves where he is. And now he will be, you know, along with Tatis, who I also didn't mention before as another player that got an eternal contract from the Padres. Those are the two guys. Those are the guys that are going to kind of anchor the Padres for the next 10 years as Machado and others start to age out.
All right, let's go around the league very quickly before we say goodbye. Cool story coming out of Tampa. Jake Mangum. Who is Jake Mangum? 29-year-old, light hitting power-wise, outfielder, who is the all-time hits leader in the Southeastern Conference, the SEC, the biggest, best conference in college baseball. A truly legendary college baseball character. But because he didn't really place a whole lot of good center field and had no power, he just didn't have an obvious path to the major leagues. Well, he debuted this week and has been absolutely raking for the Tampa Bay Rays, known as the mayor of Starkville, Mississippi. Jake Mangum is here, and he is a delight. He's a delight to watch. He's a very different style of player. Short swing, right to the ball. He would have been a perennial all-star in 1935. Like, it's a good watch.
He is an easy guy to root for. Switch hitter to debut at age 29, to be in a few different organizations. You know, you wouldn't assume the guy that has the most hits in the SEC would take that long to get to the majors, but because he had this tweener profile, he just never quite popped on prospect lists. And yeah, and I guess also because he was older when he got drafted, and then COVID immediately happened. So like, his pro career really didn't start until he was 25. Like, he was already kind of off prospect list at that point because he was so much older than everybody else. And now, hilariously enough, he's one of the oldest players on the Rays as a rookie, and now represents an interesting character in this strange season for the 2025 Tampa Bay Rays at George M. Steinbrenner.
If I'm drafting players to get a weird movie made about them one day, like the Kurt Warner movie, Mangum, if he now has like a couple all-star seasons, good pick. Pirates option David Bednar, the Yinzer, a multi-time all-star for the Buccos, has just been going through it. He has been wearing it. He is not having a hashtag good time. And so he will try and figure things out in not his hometown of Indianapolis, where the Pirates AAA team is. Colton Cowser, Baltimore Oriole, who was the runner-up for the Rookie of the Year last year, broke his thumb, fractured his thumb, sliding into first base. I love Colton, but dog, that's just, don't do that. Don't slide into first base. It's not worth it at all.
This sucks because we love Colton Cowser. I will say, I am excited for Heston Kjerstad to like play
get the run
and see what that looks like, because he has earned it with his performance. The depth chart has not granted him the opportunity, and now, because this is how baseball works, he will have this this 6 week plus stretch to hopefully play every day for the Orioles.
Nate Eovaldi, Nasty Nate, throws a Maddux last night, a complete game under 100 pitches. He 99 pitches against the Reds in Cincinnati, which is a great place to hit, does not allow a run. Absolute freaking heck yeah. We had 16 shutouts last year. This is number one of this season. That number obviously used to be way higher. I saw some tweet from some aggregation account that was like, Nate Eovaldi, all caps, throws complete game shutout. And I'm laughing at the idea if we had Twitter in like 1952. And like, it just wouldn't, you be wouldn't like, even
yeah, what's the big it? Deal? You finished yeah, the game. Congrats. That's what you're supposed
Whatever
to do.
Not.
It was a great contrast to the night earlier when rookie Kumar Rocker got blasted by the Reds. The Reds scored 14 runs on Monday. They score 0 runs on Tuesday as Eovaldi goes back out there. And yeah, against the top of the order, Bruce Bochy was just like, let him cook. Let's see Nasty Nate get this thing done. And that's exactly what he did. One more note, Jake, before we say goodbye. Lance Lynn.
Also saying goodbye.
Hanging him up. Also saying goodbye. Lance Lynn, what a career. Now, Lance Lynn, you think, oh, Lance Lynn, you guys were just talking about complete games. Well, Lance Lynn, that guy, he would seem to embody the guy. You can't get the ball out of that guy's hands. He's going to finish what he started. Lance Lynn, 4 career complete games in 340 career starts, which is not necessarily a reflection on Lance Lynn, who had many great seasons, including one hell of a peak from 2019 to 2021, which is, by the way, especially impressive considering that's when the balls were just completely out of control juiced, and Lance Lynn was munching innings with the best of them. But yeah, only 4 complete games, which really speaks to the era that we exist in now. It is just not something that pitchers are given the opportunity to do. I'm sure Lance Lynn would have loved to have more than 4, but that is not the era that he played in. And so he finished his career with over 2,000 career innings, about 31 career WAR. He will absolutely be on a Hall of Fame ballot in 5 years, and he will not get any votes, but he will show up on there because he pitched for a long time and was generally quite successful.
Goodbye.
Thank you all for listening. Thank you to producer Carter Singh for making this show possible. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. And we will talk to you all on Friday.